This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When C.J. Scarlett was a teenager, she saw a woman at the airport who looked very polished. She was wearing a suit, had a fancy handbag, and fancy shoes. And at that moment, C.J. decided that this woman was exactly who she wanted to be when she grew up. She was a professional. But it took C.J. a while to figure out exactly what kind of professional she wanted to be. She tried out firefighting, she served in the Marine Corps as a photojournalist, and she worked in the North Carolina Attorney General's office as Director of Victims Issues. But she said that her current endeavor is where she has truly found her bliss. CJ is now an entrepreneur who's working to reduce acts of crime and violence. She founded an initiative called 10 for Humanity that aims to use emerging technology to reduce acts of violence globally by 10% in 10 years. The first product is called the Tiger Eye Security Sensor. That will debut later this year. CJ joins us now to talk about her life and her work. CJ Scarlett, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. I really appreciate you having me.
Well, it's good to have you here. So the marine attire, that was not the professional look you were going for.
Not quite.
Well, we're going to get there in a minute. But I want you to start out by telling us about your early years growing up in California and Connecticut. Right?
Yes, I was born at the Marine Base at Camp Pendleton, California. My dad was a Marine. And we moved between Camp Pendleton and Barstow, which is in the Mojave Desert. I thought that was fascinating as a child because we would chase iguanas and throw rocks at sidewinders and find Indian artifacts that we thought were just junk and probably were very valuable. And when my dad was deployed, we would go to Connecticut. So I spent most of my time between California and Connecticut. When I was 12, my father retired from the Marine Corps, and he had worked in a landscaping job. He worked two or three jobs while he was raising us. And I was totally moving to Arkansas, and I cried because the only thing I knew about the South was what I had seen on Hee Haw. Mm. And when I fell asleep before we crossed the Arkansas line, and when I woke up, the first thing I saw was a Piggly Wiggly grocery store. And I cried and cried. I was so upset. It was exactly like Hee Haw.
Yeah.
The little town we moved into was Mena, Arkansas, famous for the airport where they would exchange the guns and the drugs and money for the Nicaraguan affair.
The Iran-Contra.
The Iran-Contra affair,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So but you obviously didn't know that at the time. So how old were you then?
I was 12.
And you had a pretty big family, right?
I did. I had five brothers and sisters. I was the twin sister of the firstborn son, fourth child in line. And in order to get attention in that family, which was difficult, I became a superstar.
Ooh.
I became the one who was out there saying, watch me, see me, see me. So that was my role in the family. We had all the roles filled, and that was mine.
That was yours. Well, so what? How did you make that adjustment now after having laid eyes on the Piggly Wiggly and knowing this would be your life?
It was very difficult because I had been in gymnastics in Connecticut, and they didn't have any sports teams for the girls. They wouldn't let the girls run the boys' track field. They cut the pages on biology or on reproduction out of the biology books because they didn't want teenagers to learn about sex. So they were very rigid in their thinking, and it was a dry county, and the thought behind that kind of permeated the whole town. It was a little bit like out of, what's the movie? The dancing movie.
Saturday Night Fever?
No.
Fame.
No, it's the one
Footloose?
About Footloose.
All right, you just,
yes.
I am a repository of
yes, there were
America.
There were churches that would protest the square dancing.
Oh my goodness.
That they would have in the square on like the Bicentennial, for example. So it was very, very different from what I'd grown up with. I had relatively liberal parents at the time and got into this more rigid mindset in Arkansas, and I struggled with that. I think all my siblings struggled with that, although most of my family still lives there.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, your dad was a Marine, and sometimes we hear that, you know, if you come from a military family or somebody in the family is a military, it's a pretty regimented life for the family as well.
Yeah, my mother wouldn't let us call them ma'am and sir. And
ah.
To this day, I don't know why. And now I say it all the time because I live back in the South here in North Carolina. But at the time, she was very careful about drawing a line between my father's work persona and his home persona. Although he did wake us up in the morning going da 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 every morning. It was torture.
Well, now I'm wondering about this. You've got this kind of repressed a version of the South, a place in the South is when the Arkansas South, where they're tearing the reproduction pages out of the biology book. There's no dancing. And you're making your mark as a showy young girl. I mean, how did that play as the girl who's trying to get attention, you know, in the midst of all this repression?
Well, I certainly didn't think like most of the people, or as they appeared to me, I didn't think like most of the people that were there. I didn't want to act like most of the people that were there, and I stayed relatively good, in quotations, until I hit 15. And man, did I go off on a tear when I hit 15. My poor parents had to survive me from 15 to 17, and I do not envy them. I'm lucky because my chickens did not come home to roost with my own kids. But when I was 15, I set my sights on the most popular boy in high school, and I determined that he was going to be my boyfriend. And I stalked him. According to the legal definition, I stalked this poor guy until he became my boyfriend. Now, to go back just a little bit, when I was 13, I had a neighbor who molested me. He was the father of a friend of mine. They came up from Texas to visit his mother, who lived a couple doors down from us. And I really didn't know what to do with that information. He was pretty creepy. I mean, everybody could tell that he had the creep factor going on, but nobody appeared to notice when he would do really inappropriate things. And so I wasn't quite sure what to do with that. And then when I hit 14, my sister married a guy who was very abusive to her, and he molested me. And those two incidents in my childhood kind of set the stage for what was going to happen later on. And so when I hit 15, it was like I wanted to take my body back and say, this is mine. I will do with it what I want.
But you're saying you were molested twice before you were 15.
Twice before I was 15.
Were you able to tell anybody? Were you able to talk about it at all?
No. We didn't have particularly great boundaries in my family. And I didn't know that no was an option. I was raised to be a people pleaser, and that you don't ever make anybody uncomfortable. Under any circumstances, you must make people around you feel comfortable. And so when I would be in a situation that made me very uncomfortable, I would go against my own intuition and normalize the situation. So the incidents with my brother-in-law and with the neighbor went on for a period of several years. And I don't think I even shared it with my friends. It was just, I didn't even share it with the daughter of my neighbor.
We are meeting C.J. Scarlett today on The State of Things. She is an entrepreneur today, but she has had quite a life that included a stint in the Marines and as a firefighter. You talked about those molestations and you got pregnant.
Yes, I was 15 years old. So I got Robert, the boyfriend, and immediately got pregnant. And the moment I found that I was pregnant, I told him, and he left town 2 days later and joined the Navy and left me to deal with all the fallout. And I had to tell my father, which was the hardest thing I have ever done. I had to tell my father that I was pregnant, and he just sobbed. He was so disappointed in me, and I was disappointed in myself. And it's not like I was totally unaware of birth control, but when you're 15, where do you, in a town like that, where do you go for birth control? I mean, everybody knows everybody. So I really didn't give that much thought. My parents took me for an abortion. I wasn't really given a choice, and my mother later on, you know, apologized for that. And I don't know what I would have done if I'd been given a choice, to be quite honest with you. I'd probably be the manager at the Dairy Queen in Mena, Arkansas right now if I'd stayed there and married Robert. But I didn't. And I developed, as a result of that, a reputation in school. I was the fast girl. And that was not a fun place to be in a little town filled with people with a lot of prejudices and a lot of small thinking.
Because everybody knew what happened, right?
Everybody knew what happened. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew the whole story. Everybody knew about the abortion. It was the worst day of my life was when my twin brother, I was walking down the hall and he bumped into me and he said, "Out of my way, slut," and he shoved me into the locker.
Your twin brother.
Twin brother, who I love and who we are extremely close, but he was so embarrassed by what had happened and by everybody's talk about me that he had a reaction to that.
Here is the great sorrowful paradox in all of this, that when it's on you, when you can be seen at fault, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how the story was told. When we can put the fault on you, everybody knows it. When the fault in the two times you were molested, and the fault is elsewhere, very clearly, nobody can talk about that.
No, and I accepted that as my shame. Those things that were happening, I believe there was something inherently wrong with me that made good people do bad things. And that's a really tragic way to grow up, It led me to make tragic mistakes. It led me to situations where I was hurt again, where I probably didn't need to be if I'd had any boundaries, any physical and emotional boundaries around me.
How'd you get out of Arkansas?
Well, when I graduated from high school, I went and joined the Forest Service. It was the Young Adult Conservation Corps that was located at a Forest Service camp in Mansfield, Arkansas. And I had so much fun. I got to plant hundreds of thousands of trees. I got to build trail, got to put out a few forest fires. And I was one of like 8 girls in a camp of 80 guys. And so I had boyfriend 24/7. I was just,
and a lot of physical activity.
And
right?
A lot of physical activity. Yeah. I loved the physical activity of it. When I was still working for the Forest Service, I got a phone call from a woman that was a friend. She and her mother were artists, and I had posed for them, done some nude posing when I was 17. And throughout the years, while I was posing for her, she would ask me about my hopes and dreams and what I wanted from life. And I would tell her I wanted to go to college. I wanted to travel the world. I wanted to go to fascinating places, meet fascinating people. Well, she called me on this day and she said, I have an opportunity for you that will get you out of Arkansas. And I was thrilled. She said, come to my house.
We're going to take a break right there and find out precisely what that opportunity was and how those aspirations were fulfilled when I continue my conversation with C.J. Scarlett, an entrepreneur who is working to use technology to curb human violence. You'll hear more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and my guest this hour is C.J. Scarlett. She's an entrepreneur, former Marine, dedicated to addressing human violence. She spent 2 decades working with victims of crime as victims advocate in the North Carolina Attorney General's office. It is one of many things she has done. She's now the CEO of 10 for Humanity, an organization that aims to reduce acts of violence through technology. So we're getting you out of Arkansas, and you got to express your dreams and aspirations to a woman who said, I think I can make it happen. What happened?
Yeah, and this started the darkest year of my life. I went to this woman's house, and she pulled out an ad, and she showed it to me, and it was an ad for an executive assistant that paid $60,000 a year. Well, in 1980, that's a lot of money, and I said, this is great, but I'm not qualified for that. She said, no. The gentleman who placed this ad is the one that's interested in you. He had seen a painting of you and wants you to be his mistress. And if you will go down to Florida and live with him, he will travel the world with you. He will send you to college. You will meet fascinating people. Everything I ever said to her, she regurgitated back to me. And I was excited, but my stomach didn't feel right about this. She said, my father will train you for this man. And at that point, her father came in and she retreated and he began to assault me. And I managed to push him away and I ran to my car and I just got the lock put down on the door when he grabbed the handle. And he's screaming the whole time I'm driving off with the gravel flying. He's screaming, don't you dare tell, don't you dare tell. And I didn't tell for a really long time. It was probably 15 years later before it occurred to me that I had been groomed for human trafficking. That had not occurred to me. I thought that there was this mysterious businessman who wanted me as his mistress. But what they were going to do was get me down to Florida, probably get me hooked on drugs, and I would have been on the streets. And it was devastating to realize that. I had a friend in high school that I met years later who said that they had done something similar with her, trying to get her to go down. And I wonder how many other girls they got. That actually did.
And sort of part of this was the fact that you had expressed, you know, sort of what's on your mind. So your hopes and aspirations then become this, get twisted in that way.
Oh, yeah.
To draw you into this thing.
Yes. And then that followed with me going back to school back to college. I had started in high school and I went back to community college. And I was in October that I started dating a sheriff's deputy. And on our second date, my car had broken down. And he took me to his house, his apartment, and I sat on the couch and suddenly he swooped me up in his arms and he started taking me to the bedroom. And I'm saying, hey, that's not funny. Put me down, put me down, put me down. He didn't put me down and he raped me brutally. And it was horrifying because he said he'd been shot in a gun battle with some perpetrators, but his body was almost like he had scars like he had been cut in half and pasted back together. And I was so fixated on that while I felt like there was a monster raping me. And I don't remember anything about how I got home. I don't remember anything about how I spent the next several weeks. I dropped out of school and I moved back to Arkansas, or back to Mena with my parents. And I went into a deep depression.
Did you feel at all that you were able to report?
No. He was a cop and he told me no one would believe me. And this is 1980. So, you know, A, we didn't talk about those sorts of things. There was no term date rape. So what do you call it when somebody attacks you when you're dating them? It's not, there wasn't a category for it for me to even put it in my mind. And he was a policeman. And what was going to happen to me if I tried to go to a sheriff's station and report a sheriff's deputy had raped me? I would have been laughed out of town. But it really never occurred to me to go tell. And I regret that, too, because heaven only knows how many other women he might have assaulted as a result of that.
And as you said, it took you a while to realize that you're not at fault. But what's going through your mind now? You've had this series of assaults and attempts. And you said earlier you've sort of been raised to try to please and put it all behind you. What's going through your mind in terms of, what are you thinking at this point?
I thought there was something wrong with me. As I said before, that made good people do bad things. I thought there was something about my own behavior. I questioned every aspect of myself, looking for what it was about me that made me a victim. I responded to all the cues. You know, perpetrators groom their victims, and I fit the pattern so beautifully that they could spot me in a heartbeat. And I was very vulnerable to that.
Were you able to talk about any of this, even in the abstract, to friends or at this point? Or
no, I was so filled with shame and self-loathing that I kept that buried deeply inside. I was terrified that people would see what was really inside of me and would run in horror and never want to be near me again.
Meanwhile, you've come home and clearly you're not doing well. What are your family and friends thinking is going on?
I don't know. I was so dissociated during that period. Right. I was oblivious to what was happening in the world around me, the people around me. One day my dad said, I want you to talk to the Marine recruiter. I think that this could be good for you. And so I did. And I aced the ASVAB, the military entrance exam, and was told that I could go into any field I wanted. And so I chose photojournalism and I signed a 6-year contract for that. In between when I signed in probably February to when I left for boot camp in April, I was in the delayed entry program as what they call a poolee. And so I learned how to field strip an M16. I learned how to march. I learned my general orders. A lot of things that I was going to learn in boot camp, I learned then. But the recruiters, especially back then, had a field day with female recruits. And again, I was very vulnerable, and my recruiter took advantage of that situation. He was married with 4 kids, but every recruiter, every female that came through that I knew was having sex with one of the recruiters. And I fell right into that pattern. And so again, the shame of all these things happening, all these different events, nobody talks about serial victimization, and it's very real. People who are molested as children are 3 times as likely to be molested as adults than those who are not. And I didn't have a clue why these things kept happening. I didn't recognize that it was the lack of boundaries, the inability to trust my own intuition, and knowing that I could say no. I really didn't believe I could say no in these situations. And so it was very tragic. But the beautiful thing that came out of this is that I flourished in the Marine Corps. I was the honor graduate in boot camp because I knew everything before I left. Mm-hmm. My dad had been in boot camp at Parris Island in the 50s, and he told stories about how he'd been beaten every day and punched in the face and had a tooth knocked out. And so I went to boot camp expecting to be beaten, and all they do is yell at me. And the girls at night would cry in their beds and say, I want to go home. And I'd lay there and think, this is it? They're just going to yell at me? I can do this. And so I was honor graduate, and I graduated as an E3 Lance Corporal, which is very rare.
At that stage, because you'd
yes.
been in so for such a short time. And you were a photojournalist. Tell us about that experience.
Oh, it was fantastic. I got to do something different every single day. I got to interview infantrymen and generals and movie stars and ride in tanks and stand on the skids of a helicopter and fire a machine gun and fire light armored tank weapons. I got to do a little bit of everything I ever wanted to do in the military. And then I got to tell stories about it. So it was fascinating.
Well, one of the stories, I think one of the better ones, is about your first day on the job.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, my first day on the job. I had just come out of photojournalism school, and I was stationed at Camp Pendleton. And when I got to the office, there was literally nobody there because they were covering a joint Marine Corps-Navy exercise. And so someone told me that I needed to go escort a film crew, a TV film crew that was on the scene. So I go out there. The driver drives me to the beach, and the film crew's filming, and everything's going fine. The ships are sailing, and the helicopters are flying, and the troops are shooting. And they decide that they want to get a shot of the machine gunners. So they start to walk out there. And I'm like, are you crazy? And so I go, cease fire, cease fire, cease fire. And so the machine gunners stop. And then I hear down the line, cease fire, cease fire, cease fire. And the ship stops sailing and the helicopters land and the tanks stop rolling. I was like, there, take your photos now. I didn't realize they were firing blanks. I had no idea. And a general comes over the hill and says, who stopped my exercise? And every finger pointed to me. And that was the day I earned my nickname, Corporal Gullible. Which I held for
Corporal
many
Gullible,
years.
You just stopped the entire United States Marines. Well,
I stopped a war.
I get you. Yeah, you stopped a war. I'll give you a better name than that. What did happen? Did you get in trouble?
I got the moniker, first of all. Yeah. But then the guys that I worked with thought I was, you know, just dipsy. For a long time, they thought I was just dipsy. But there was a guy in a foxhole right next to me that I ended up marrying. He was also in public affairs. And his first impression of me, thankfully, was changed when he spent a little more time around me. So
tell us more about these. Were you ever in combat situations? Or what kinds of pictures were you taking?
I was not in combat situations. Yeah. Women were not allowed in combat then, but we also didn't have any. Beirut occurred while I was in from 81 to 86. Yeah. But we didn't have any situations that I would have responded to. I would have taken a bullet for Ronnie Reagan. I mean, I was hardcore. Mm-hmm. Republican, take the hill, take charge kind of person back then.
But again, in terms of, I mean, it's a unique position to be in this extreme kind of exquisite environment of the place like the Marine Corps, and to be a witness to it, not just, you know, participating, but also to be able to step back and take pictures. Were you able to reflect on sort of what this was all about?
Yes, I was. And the great thing was everybody has a story to tell. And the honor of being able to tell that story and have it appear in print was tremendous. We used to make fun of the broadcasters, no offense. We used to walk by and...
I don't know. We're eminently mockable. Yeah, I have fun.
There was a lot of competition between the broadcasters and the photojournalists, but it was an amazing experience to have, and I'm so grateful that I did it.
Did you learn anything in this time? Again, you think about journalism, it is a time to reflect. You can sort of step back and watch things. And I wonder if you were then beginning to think about your own life, if this gave you any insight, or because it's a pretty busy time. I mean, you've got a full-time job as a photojournalist and the Marines. So maybe not, but I wonder if this was a time.
No, those secrets stayed buried pretty deep. I mean, I felt like if I started crying or I started talking that the world was going to end. And so I kept those things buried very deeply inside of me until 1986, when I started going to therapy to talk about some of these issues. And the world didn't end exactly, but it ended up costing me my marriage.
Well, you talked about your first marriage. You met Ernie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell us about that and whether you felt you could talk with him. I guess, interestingly enough, you were actually dating one of the Iranian hostages, right?
Yes. Stephen Kirtley was one of the Iranian hostages. And before I went into boot camp, I was introduced to him. And so we started going out. And then after I got out of boot camp, we continued our relationship for some months. He was a really great guy.
Ernie was determined to.
But Ernie was determined to have me. He would leave me little love notes on my windshield that said, good morning, princess, I owe you 10 kisses. And he would send me little pictures. And this whole time I wasn't dating him. I was just kind of brushing him off. You know, this guy has got a crush on me. And I just kind of left it at that. But once I broke up with Steve, Ernie really put me to the test with his romanticism. He was charming. He was utterly charming, and I was taken with him.
Well, as you said, it all went well, but then you did seek counseling.
Yes, and one night I couldn't contain it anymore, and I broke down, and I told Ernie everything that had happened to me. And I was terrified that he was going to turn from me in disgust, and he didn't. He didn't know what to do with it, though. He'd never encountered anything like that in his life. And he struggled with the notion that I had these issues that were impacting our marriage. It helped him to know why these things had happened, you know, what the effect was. But he didn't know what to do with it. So he wasn't fully supportive. He kind of wanted me to keep it hidden. so that it wouldn't impact my military career. So I couldn't go to a counselor within the military because I was told that I wouldn't get a promotion if they saw that in my military records, for example. And so the one time I did see a psychiatrist there, I tore the page out of my record book and destroyed it. By 1990, things were really rocky with us. And one day I was sitting in a United Way board meeting. I'd gotten out of the Marine Corps in 1986 and went to work for United Way. And all the town leaders were there for this United Way meeting. And all of a sudden I burst into tears. And I ran to the bathroom stall and I sobbed for 2 hours. And I had no idea why I was crying. But everything came tumbling down all at the same time. And that blackness, that horrible year of 19 came bubbling up. And I couldn't contain it anymore. And it was the second worst time of my life. After 19, that year was the worst year of my life because all of a sudden my secrets were out.
Your secrets were out. Your emotions were showing. And so it's also a turning point. We're going to talk more about that in a second. But I'm wondering for Ernie how much of the difficulty for him might have been the facts that now are revealed. But also, was there a side of you that you hadn't revealed? I mean, this is an emotional outburst that perhaps he hadn't seen before, or an emotional side of you that you also had to keep.
Yeah, well, I had to admit to him that I had been a tramp in high school. Yeah. He didn't know that about me. He thought that I was just this good girl who'd been a good girl all along. And so he had to reframe his perspective of me, his perception of me. And he didn't know where to put that any more than I knew where to put that.
Right, right. Because you're learning, you're beginning to see yourself fully.
Yes.
And live your life and embody your own life. And you're starting a family at this time, right?
Yes, I had two boys in 1984 and 1987. And I'm getting ready to be a grandma. The oldest one's going to have twins soon.
Oh, congratulations. Thanks. Well, so, but what about the impact on them and you as a mother and raising them? How much of this did you have to sort of keep from them, and how difficult was that?
I did keep they knew that I was going through a very difficult period. And when they were very young, their father went into the first Gulf War. And our marriage never recovered from the disclosure that I made several years before. And we ended up divorcing. And that was really, really hard on the boys. Now, as they've grown up and I've started telling my story more, they're familiar with all the details of that. They don't know everything that I've shared today. They will now. But they support me 100%. They're just amazing kids.
We are meeting C.J. Scarlett today on The State of Things. Talking about by now you have left the Marines. You have this awful moment where you burst into tears at a meeting, but it is a kind of a turning point for you. Mm-hmm. Is this when you decided, or shortly after that, decided to go back to school?
Well, within a week after I had that breakdown, I was diagnosed with lupus and scleroderma, which are autoimmune conditions. And I was debilitated on and off over the years. I wanted to go back to college so badly, and Ernie didn't want me to go. And he kept saying, we can't afford it, we can't afford it. So what I did was I went to the VA, and I arranged through Voc Rehab for them to pay for my schooling at Virginia Wesleyan College. I got a part-time job that paid almost as much as my full-time job did as a representative of EarthShare. And then I went to work and quit my job. And I sat on the couch at home and I waited for my husband to come home. And I said, I'm going to school. And he said, we can't afford it. And I said, here's how we're going to afford it. And he had no argument left. He was not happy. He was not happy. But I went and it changed my life. It was my liberal arts education. And I learned how to think critically for the first time. And I really blossomed.
Your marriage didn't survive.
My marriage did not survive. Mm-hmm. Ernie was sent over to Tokyo to work at Pacific Stars and Stripes. And I was offered the opportunity to through the VA to go to graduate school. And I chose to go to graduate school.
Is this when you started studying human violence?
Yes. My undergrad is in political science. And then when I went to Old Dominion University, it was kind of a criminology, sociology, interdisciplinary degree. And I wanted to look at violence from every angle and to try to understand how people could do the things they did. And my capstone course was called Understanding Human Violence. And it was like the bow on the package. It pulled everything together for me. It was a fascinating degree to study.
And you started to interact more with assault victims as well.
Yes. In 1990, when everything fell apart, I got into therapy through the local rape crisis center in group therapy and individual therapy. And group therapy was tremendously helpful because I could borrow people's feelings. Mm. When I couldn't feel them for myself, I would feel outraged for another woman's story and think, that shouldn't have happened to you. You didn't deserve that. And then I would think, wait a second. If her story is like my story and it's not her fault, then that means it's not my fault. It was very helpful. in the process of healing.
You ended up moving to Elizabeth City, and you took a job at that time. Very interesting job because of when you took the job there in Elizabeth City.
Yes, I was still in graduate school, and I was offered the opportunity to go apply for the role of executive director of Kids First, which is where Little Rascals happened. And the town was very traumatized. The whole town had PTSD. I swear they did.
We should say that this was a terrible sexual abuse story.
Yes.
At a daycare center.
Yes.
It was awful.
Some children accused a couple who ran their daycare center of molesting them. And it was a horrible ordeal that really traumatized the entire town. And so I took over after that event. It turns out that they hired me out of all these people because the agency was going down the tubes and they sort of needed someone to finish the process. Well, when I found that out, that just made me mad. It's like, no, you don't do that to me. So I ended up doubling the staff, moving us to a larger location. The agency is still in place 20-something years later, and kids are being helped all the time. I loved that job so much because I would see these children come in so damaged. And in 6 months, just having somebody say, it wasn't your fault, and those children were healed.
Talk more about that as our conversation continues. My guest today is entrepreneur CJ Scarlett. She hopes to reduce acts of violence around the world by 10% in the next decade. We'll find out how she plans to do that when our conversation continues on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with CJ Scarlett, founder and president of Tiger Eye Sensor Incorporated. It's a company that's producing the first ever hands-free, voice-activated personal security device. It's designed to deter crime and violence. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes, but I want to talk more about sort of going to Elizabeth City and working with traumatized children after this, the sort of Little Rascals episode there. You have really developed some ideas about, and they're ancient ideas, in some ways, that you've begun to embrace about pain and suffering and about sort of how we can manage and move forward in the face of trauma.
Yes. If it's very counterintuitive, you have to go into the pain in order to get out of it. And only when the pain became greater than my ability to contain it was I willing to deal with that. And I think that's true for most people. We will carry pain until it eats us alive like a cancer, or until we get cancer, or until we get lupus and scleroderma. My body simply could not go on with me functioning the way I was, and it quit. And the beautiful part about that was that it forced me inside. It forced me to go inside and think about and reframe the things that had happened to me. In the process, I flourished. I actually, in 2000, had to close down a company that I had started because lupus and scleroderma had hit me so hard, and I still hadn't fully dealt with everything that I was, you know, all the emotional issues around the molestations. And I became totally debilitated. I had to go up and down the stairs on my hands and knees. I couldn't lift a coffee cup. I couldn't turn a doorknob. And the doctors told me that my heart was failing and that I was going to die. And I was petrified. I was depressed. I curled up into a ball and I waited to die. And then a friend got me an appointment with a Tibetan Buddhist Lama. And I poured out my tale of woe to the Lama, and I waited for him to shower me with sympathy. And that's what I learned, that Lamas don't do dramas. This Lama looked at me very compassionately but very sternly and said, stop feeling sorry for yourself and start thinking about the happiness of other people. And I was shocked. I thought he was saying to me that I didn't deserve to feel sorry for myself. Well, that's exactly what he was saying, but I took offense. But on the way home, I was trying to think of what can I possibly do in my debilitated state. I was in so much emotional and physical pain. What can I do? And an ambulance went by with a siren blaring. And I said a quick prayer for the person inside that they would find help and healing. I thought, well, I can do that. So I started sending love to the drivers around me. And then I made a practice of doing daily acts of kindness. I would give my cane to a woman who was struggling to walk and let the mom with the crying baby go ahead of me in line at the grocery store. Little things that didn't cost anything in terms of effort or time or money. And I felt happier. And the more I did, the happier I felt. And I reached a place, Frank, where I was so filled with joy and gratitude for my life, for my illness, for everything, for the abuse that I had endured. I was so grateful for all the experiences of my life that came together that I reached a point where it was no longer matter whether I was sick or ill or even living or dying. I was just happy. And at that point, my condition went into remission.
You're going to have to help us with this. I think we can, or I can begin to understand what it might mean to get out of my own self and mm-hmm. understand that other people are suffering too. We won't get into suffering envy. Maybe it's more, maybe it's mm-hmm. less. But in any case, that maybe by thinking about them, I can spend a little less time thinking about myself. But what about this idea that you said I could express gratitude mm-hmm. for the sexual abuse, for the suffering, for the pain that you've, the pain of lupus and scleroderma? What does that mean?
Well, although I would not choose to go back and do it all again, I could see where it led me. I could see where all these experiences shaped me into the person that I have become, who now has the not just the desire to end human violence, but the ability to do it because of my experiences. They have served me. I believe there's some karmic payback going on there, you know, so that's always an element of that. But going through the pain only took me so far. I had to reach that point where I was willing to let go of the pain, and focusing on other people's suffering and recognizing that their suffering was my suffering. It was exactly the same, and we were exactly the same, no matter how differently they looked from me. It led me to a place of peace that I could not have attained if I had just stayed focused on the trauma and the pain of what had happened to me.
There's another counterintuitive element in this, as I understand it, is it not only were you able to sort of look at the pain and suffering of others and understand it as yours as well, but also to go deeply into the pain and experience it fully and mm-hmm. not run from it, not try to find the antidote or the analgesic, but in fact experience fully the pain itself.
Yes, and that is counterintuitive, but we tend to run from pain. We push it from us. We try to do everything we can to remove ourselves from it. But in fact, the ability to embrace the pain that's already there, it's not like you're creating new pain. It's already there. Honor it. Say thank you for being the pain, for being there, because you're trying to tell me something. You're trying to teach me something. Then that gives you the ability to say thank you and let go.
So through all of this, these enormous insights, spiritual, emotional, psychological insights, you moved to Raleigh and you worked for the Attorney General's office, right?
Yes, I did. I worked there for 3 years and I loved that job because it was like being an entrepreneur and getting a steady paycheck at the same time. My boss was wonderful. She let me do just about anything I wanted. So I would go and visit the domestic violence shelters and I would visit with the staff first, and then I would take out a pack of cigarettes and put on my bunny slippers and spend the night with the women at the shelter and let them tell their stories. We'd stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning, and I heard stories that would make your hair stand on end. And I was at the shelters when the guys would drive by screaming and shooting their shotguns, you know, just, I know you're in there kind of thing. So I got to know victims from different kinds of victims who had different experiences from my own, which led to further healing on my part, but also made me more aware of what their issues were, so that I could take that information back to the Attorney General and we could craft legislation or programs or whatever that were going to meet their needs.
What did come from this?
I implemented and co-chaired the first statewide automated victim notification system. It's called SAVIN. And what it does is it calls the victim 48 hours before their perpetrators are released from custody. There have been cases where a victim would turn around in the grocery store and there'd be her rapist. This gives victims an opportunity to protect themselves and to mentally prepare themselves for the fact that their perpetrators are out on the streets.
This is fascinating. You have been a victim of violence. You endured it for a long time. You then studied it academically. Then you get into public policy and begin to sort of change things at the macro level on a large scale. Now you're an entrepreneur and you have ideas about the ways that new technology can actually protect women. Tell us about that.
I was reading a book in January 2013 called Abundance: The Future is Better Than You Think by Peter Diamandis, and that book changed the course of my life. He talks about how emerging technology is being used to address humanity's grand challenges like poverty and hunger and climate change and security. And I was so inspired by this book, and I thought, what could I do that could impact a billion lives? And my criminal justice history kept rising, and I kept pushing it down because I'd grown tired of dealing with crime and violence after they occurred. I wanted to do something to keep from happening at all. And then suddenly it dawned on me that I could do that using technology. Technology is our future. There is a tsunami coming, folks. And a lot of people are out there, as the water recedes, picking up a starfish and going, oh, look, a starfish, you know, and they don't know that the tsunami is about to hit. All this technology is going to change our lives. And it can be used for bad or it can be used for good. And I want to find good uses for it.
So tell us about the Tiger Eye security sensor.
Tess was born of the desire to find a product that could go to the market that was different from what was being offered. You know, you have your traditional mace and handguns and things like that that require you to have the physical and mental wherewithal to use them in a moment of crisis, which is very difficult to summon. There were products that were coming out that required you to press a button or hit some numbers to activate them. And I knew from my own experience that when you are a victim of crime, you're protecting your face or your abdomen or whatever you're doing, but you're not pressing a button anywhere. So the idea for having a voice-activated device cropped up. And I love this idea because all you have to do is call for help.
So describe it for us. You brought one in. It's a
yes.
very tiny device.
It's and very tiny. It's about the size of a quarter.
And you'd wear it.
And you wear it, and it has jewelry covers, so it can go with your little black dress or it can go with a man's name badge or a child's Batman T-shirt or whatever you want. And when you call out for help, a bright LED light comes on, and it starts photographing the perpetrator. In the meantime, it collects 5 seconds before you were activated. It's got the perpetrator's voice saying, this is a stick-up or give me your purse or whatever they say. That data is sent to the cloud for use by law enforcement so they can identify, capture, and prosecute the perpetrator. Then it connects you with a two-way live monitoring operator who asks you what the nature of your emergency is, calls police or an ambulance to your GPS location, tells the perpetrator to leave the scene because the police are on the way, and then collects that data. They stay with you on the line until help arrives.
So this would be, you'd have to have a security service that would go along with the
device. Yes, a monitoring service. You don't have to have a home monitoring service, but you have to have a monitoring service that we will offer. We're actually a business-to-business company. Our clients are the alarm companies, and then they will sell to folks, mm-hmm. and they'll probably give the device away for free in exchange for the monitoring contracts.
And who's the audience? Who are you trying to reach here?
We're trying to reach, well, everybody, but mm-hmm. our initial target markets are female college students who are several times more likely to be sexually assaulted during those first 2 years in school. Mm-hmm. Very difficult time for them. I mean, that happened to me my first year in school. And realtors, business travelers, social workers, people who find themselves in situations where they could be in danger. But the 106 million women who are out there who get it, who every day are hyper alert, hyper vigilant about walking through a parking lot, and when they hear some footsteps behind them, their heart beats faster. This is for them. This is a way to take your home monitoring system with you wherever you go.
You know, it's clearly a great step forward, particularly when it comes to gathering evidence. Well, but on the other hand, here it is again, women are bearing the burden of defending themselves in some ways. I mean, what would you say to, I don't know if you'd call them critics, but those who would point to this as, you know, sort of a bridge technology or a bridge step to our ultimate answer?
Yeah, the ultimate answer lies in getting everyone, men, women, perpetrators, everybody on the same page. That's a really big goal, really large opportunity that will take years to achieve. And there are a lot of great people working on that problem. How do we get perpetrators to stop committing crimes, stop assaulting people? That larger question is working, you know, is being addressed at the same time we're doing this. This is only a short-term solution for people. 10 for Humanity, the parent company of TigerEye Sensor, is focused on the larger picture. And so what we're going to do is do a crowdsourcing campaign. Crowdsourcing is where you turn to the wisdom of the public to come up with solutions. And so we're going to ask the world to help us devise solutions, 9 solutions, to reduce acts of violence over the next decade. And it will be amazing the responses we get and where we get them from. There was an example of a company during the BP oil spill. They did an X Prize to get people to come up with solutions to get rid of the oil. And one of the top teams was a bunch of guys from a tattoo parlor who prototyped the solution in a hot tub. And their solution was good enough to make it to one of the top teams. So you never know. I mean, there were physicists and biologists and all these other people putting their ideas in, but you never know who's got an idea that will never see the light of day because they don't know how to bring it to market. And so we'll gather those ideas, we'll work with the inventors to bring them to market and hopefully come up with some solutions that are going to make a really big dent in the problem.
We are talking with entrepreneur, businesswoman, and emerging technology specialist CJ Scarlett today on The State of Things. What about that? How much business experience did you have? I mean, launching a business is a thing. It's a real thing.
It's a real thing. I started a company in 1999 that I had to close in 2000 when I became so ill. And I started another company with two women in 2009 that lasted for 3 years. We gave it the best we had. It was a coaching company during a time when the economy was in a downturn, and coaching is considered a benefit, so it was on the chopping block. I gained experience as an entrepreneur through those business experiences, but I've been one since I was a little girl. My grandfather had a number of patents for automotive parts, and I loved hearing stories about how he had invented these things. So being an inventor was on my bucket list. And when I got the patent for Tiger Eye, I was over the moon.
Did you do the actual the technological development? I mean, how did that all come about technically?
We've got a company, an engineering company that we're working with out of Silicon Valley that is actually doing the development of the product. They're making the magic happen. All I have to do is give the vision. I'm very good as a visionary. I'm not as good as an executor, which is why I hired a CEO this time around. Mm-hmm. To help run the company, because she can make it lead it to its full potential.
So is it the sort of thing where you talk to a bunch of engineers and say, look, we need a thing that's going to capture the voice and the image and also, I mean, and then can you make that thing work?
Yes, and it's so much more complex than I ever dreamed it would be. I thought just slap a few components together and it would work. No. It's not the way it happens. It's very complicated to make all these parts and pieces come together, which is why no one's done it this way before.
Well, and you're going to the cloud, so you somehow have to have access to either cell technology, wireless. You've got to get to the internet wherever you are.
Yes.
That's the other part of that, I guess. But the idea that too, well, first of all, you've taken this, you've approached this as a scholar and an academic, so you've studied it. You took it from the policy level, so nobody can accuse you of missing those two important points. And now there's this very practical step, which when you think about it, if men are held accountable and actually prosecuted for this, for which they have gotten away scot-free for way too long, then maybe we'll turn around and start taking the deeper solutions more seriously. I mean, sad to say it would take that, but I guess it has that virtue.
Well, that the goal is for this just, you know, not only to deter crime, but to take criminals off the streets. Because if somebody is raping someone, they're doing it to others. They will do it to others. And if we can get them off the streets, we may save a dozen women from being assaulted by that one individual. So we're hoping to make a dent in the recidivism.
And getting people thinking about this, the other nine solutions is mm-hmm. a kind of a crowdsource idea. So you know, you've got two sons, and you talked a little bit about sort of what was going on as you were raising them. What about now, your personal experiences? How much of an impact has that had on them, or do you to sort of help in helping you raise them?
Well, they look at me with awe, wonder, and disbelief because they think mom's at it again. She's got another crazy entrepreneurial idea. I know how far this is going to go. I think they're kind of going to be surprised when we get to the finish line.
You're not at the finish line. That's my next question. My last question is, what's next for you?
Once I reduce violence and put an end to it, let's see. Let me think.
So this is my
take a vacation.
Take a break. Well, okay. And then when you do that, we'll have your report on that. So please come back.
Wonderful.
CJ Scarlett, what a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
CJ Scarlett is the founder of 10 for Humanity and Tiger Eye Sensor, Inc. CJ's first product aims to deter crime and violence. The Tiger Eye Security Sensor will be available later this year, and you can find out more about it at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Cobley is our technical director. Our intern is Jess Clark, and our news director is Brent Wolf. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.